Alrighty, so the last song that we sang earlier this morning, Ancient of Days, the chorus that you would have sung is this. None above him, none before him, all of time in his hands, for his throne shall remain and ever stand. All the power, all the glory, I will trust in his name, for my God is the Ancient of Days. I don't know how much sometimes we concentrate when we're singing these words, but that chorus, it declares God as King above all, the Ancient of Days, the eternal ruler and judge, the one who is clothed in glory, the one who controls time and history itself. That's what you've just sung. And then we sing, so there's a personal response there, I will trust in his name. I will trust in him. So in that song, you are declaring his sovereign rule, his kingship, his eternal rule and judge is over my own life as well. He's the sovereign God who is perfect in wisdom and glory over my life. But what do we do when God doesn't act the way we expect? What do we do when God acts in even our own lives in a way that we don't understand or perhaps we don't even like? When you declare, as we just sung, God is sovereign, but then you turn on the TV and you see war and pain and it's spread across our globe. If God is sovereign, totally in control, why does that happen? When you declare God is sovereign, but even your own life is full of pain, possibly hardship, poverty, or broken relationships. And you think, if God is sovereign, why does that happen? When you declare, when you sing, like we've sung, God is sovereign, but then you see others around you, even loved ones, not coming to know Christ, and therefore heading to hell, despite your prayer and your testimony in their life. If God is sovereign, why does he let that happen? Do you ever question God's sovereignty? Do you ever question God's choices in his sovereignty? Do you ever disagree? Or even maybe even get upset, get angry at God's sovereign choices? Why does he do it that way? I mean, if I were God, I'd do it differently. Because as we move forward today in the book of Exodus, I think it can be a question we need to tussle with. Why, God? Why in your sovereignty, why in your infinite wisdom, why in your absolute power in this world do you do it this way instead of what I think would be a far better way, God? Because as we've already seen, Exodus, it began again with the promise of God, didn't it? His covenant promise to rescue his people from slavery, his promise to bless them as his people, to take them out of slavery in Egypt and give them the promised land. But so far, has God's sovereign choices been good? His people, I mean, they've been enslaved already for hundreds of years. And finally, God sends the one who's going to deliver them, Moses. But then we saw the last few weeks, God's plan takes another 40-year detour of Moses living in Midian. And to top it off, we saw last week, Moses doesn't really look like the man for the job, does he? He's full of doubts and excuses. Why? Why this way, God? And today, the roadmap to God's promise of rescue seems to again be very bumpy and windy. Why doesn't our sovereign God just get it over and done with? Swoop in as he could with all the angels of heaven, or simply snap his fingers, speak the word, and rescue would be complete. Instead, what does he do? He sends a reluctant, poor-speaking fugitive back to Egypt to tell Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And what happens? What do you expect's going to happen? In Exodus 5, Moses and Aaron, they go before Pharaoh and they say, "Let my people go." What's Pharaoh's response? Take a look at chapter 5, verse 2. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." I mean, Pharaoh doesn't even think about, question God's sovereignty. He outright ignores it here, doesn't he? He sees himself, actually, as a god. He sees himself as a god who's ruling a people who worship many gods, and he's seen as a son of God. Why should he obey this God of Israel? So he resists, he denies, he ignores, he refuses to listen. Instead, Pharaoh, actually, we read on in chapter 5, he decides to make things worse. He decides to punish the Israelites even more. He makes it more difficult for them to complete the job they've been enslaved to do. As we read on in chapter 5, we see now not only do the Israelites need to continue making bricks, but Pharaoh is no longer going to supply them with straw, which was a key ingredient in the bricks they made. Now they have to find the straw for themselves. Again, God's sovereign plan is taking what looks like a terrible detour or even a backward step. And then we read on in Exodus 6, we find the upset Israelite people. What do? They decide not to listen to Moses as well. They don't believe him. It seems like yet another detour, but it seems to get worse. I know we just skipped over two chapters quickly, but we reach chapter 7, and God explains to Moses more of his plan. This is God talking to Moses. Take a look at Exodus 7, verse 2 to 5. This is what God says. He says, "You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." So God, in his wisdom here, decides this rescue is going to take longer still, because he himself will harden Pharaoh's heart. Why would God choose to further harden Pharaoh's heart? We've already seen it's hard, isn't it, in chapter 5. Why would God choose to harden Pharaoh's heart and drag this out, plague after plague after plague? Well, here's the answer, one that I think becomes clearer as we work through these plagues. It's this. God is sovereign despite resistance, and even through it. I'll say that again. This is what we're going to look at today. God is sovereign despite resistance, and even through it. So even before the plagues, this battle we see this contest between Pharaoh and God. Take a look at chapter 7, verse 8 to 13. This is the start of this contest. "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'When Pharaoh says to you, perform a miracle, then say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake.' So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same thing by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staff. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord has said." So here, before the plagues, we see this kind of miniature picture of the sovereignty, the power of God that is about to be put on display. Aaron throws down his staff. It becomes a snake. Pharaoh's magicians do the same trick. It looks like a fairly even matched contest, but no. Aaron's snake swallows the Egyptian magician snakes. God's power, God's sovereignty, easily swallows up the power of Pharaoh and his so-called false gods. As you read now through the plagues that now come, God shows this incredible power over and over. Egypt tries to match it, and Egypt loses every single time. God brings forth 10 plagues on Egypt. Now, today we're going to look at the first 9 because the last deserves even more time next week. But these plagues show clearly God's unmatchable power and glory, his power over all of creation. You see, as we go through these plagues, we see God show that he is the God over all, not the false Egyptian gods. Not only did Pharaoh see himself as a god, as a son of God, but Egypt, we know, worshipped many other gods, who they believed each had power over different parts of their world and their lives. And the plagues tear all that apart. Look through these plagues. The first plague. We're going to go through this pretty quickly. God turns the water of the Nile into blood. The Nile was Egypt's entire life, really. Entire economic, agricultural heartbeat. And Harpy was the Egyptian god of the Nile. And here God's sovereignty stands over that important false god of the Egyptians. And then we get the second plague. God sends a plague of frogs. Now, Heket was the Egyptian goddess of fertility and abundance for the Egyptians. It was depicted in Egypt as a goddess with a head like a frog. But now, as we read this plague, the frogs are used for God's judgment, not fertility or abundance. We read that they actually invade even the marriage bed with their stink and their loud infestation. And then we get the third plague. God sends the gnats, the lice. Aaron strikes the dust, we read, strikes the dust of the ground with his staff, and out of the ground comes this plague of gnats. And here, as we read on this plague, there doesn't even seem to be an Egyptian god to match this, because the dust for the Egyptians was not a source of power or life, so they didn't have a god of the dust. And we see the Egyptian magicians, now they're unable to produce or try and reproduce anything similar at all. While Pharaoh remains hardened and unyielding, his magicians now see, they're starting to see the sovereign power of God, because they declare, this is the finger of God. We continue, the fourth plague. God sends the flies. And it's here that God begins to mercifully separate out his chosen people for rescue. Because incredibly, the flies, try and tell a fly where to go, the flies do not enter Goshen, where the Israelites live, judging only Egypt for its evil. Then we get the fifth plague. God sends a plague to kill all the Egyptian livestock, all the cattle, but spares any livestock belonging to the Israelites. Now, several Egyptian gods were pictured as livestock. Hathor, the cow-headed goddess of fertility and joy, Apis, the bull god of strength, and the list goes on. But again, what we're seeing here is God's sovereignty stands over those false gods in judgment. And then we get the sixth plague. Festering boils on every Egyptian. Do you see what's happening now? God's judgment is moving really closer to home now, isn't it? It's striking their very physical bodies. We see Moses and Aaron, they scatter soot into the air as God commanded, and this time, where are the Egyptian magicians? They're at home dealing with their boils. So they can't even show up to the contest. They're covered in boils too. The seventh plague. This is another turning point. As we read earlier, Steph read it out. God says he will now send the full force of his plagues against them. So he's saying things are only going to get worse. And it increases first with this plague of hail. Now think about it. Hail would have been virtually unknown in an arid place like Egypt. So this would have been clearly seen as a divine act of judgment. But again, we also see mercy. The area where the Israelites live is not impacted by the hail. But even more mercy is found here. We read that Moses' message from God, he gives the Egyptians themselves the opportunity to find protection from his judgment. And then we get the eighth plague. Things are just getting worse and worse and worse. Now it's locusts. So more than frogs, gnats or flies, locusts, they bring total destruction. They cover the ground. It says they devour what little vegetation is left. They fill every house. So what we see now is this picture of the Egyptians in judgment. They're suffering total economic, agricultural, and physical devastation. Their whole way of life is ruined. But God's judgment continues as Pharaoh's heart stays hardened. And then the last plague we look at today, the ninth plague, darkness. Now you might look at darkness and go, well, does that affect you as much as any all these other things? I mean, we have lots of darkness, about a third of, you know, half the day. So why the plague of darkness to finish things off before we hit next week with the plague on the firstborn? Well, actually, the plague of darkness hits deepest of all the plagues so far. Why? Because it actually topples over the pinnacle of the Egyptian gods, Ra, the sun god. Pharaoh himself was seen as Ra's son, king of the gods, Ra was, creator of the universe, woven into their very daily worship of the Egyptians, woven into their calendar and Pharaoh's own claim to power. So the plague of darkness, it cut to the very heart, not just of their livelihoods, but their identity, their spiritual identity and worship. So again, we see God's sovereignty stands over the Egyptians and their false gods in his judgment. So I know we've zoomed through those quickly, but we see through those nine plagues that over and over again, God reigns, God's power triumphs. Throughout the plagues, we see that despite resistance, despite Pharaoh's resistance, despite his fight against God, God's sovereignty never becomes a doubt. God is sovereign despite resistance. And that remains an unchanging truth today. God remains sovereign. God remains in control despite the sinful resistance of the world's powers and people's hearts. People still live like Pharaoh, don't they? People still live saying, who is the Lord that I should obey him? I mean, isn't that sin at its root? It's the same thing that Satan planted in Adam and Eve in the garden and in all of humanity. Sin is when we question God's rule, ignore God's rule in our lives. And what we see is the Lord still responds in the same way, displaying his power, his glory, and ultimately his just judgment. In Egypt, God was sovereign despite any resistance to that, and it's the same today. But if we dig a little deeper here in this incredible series of plagues, we see something actually even more incredible, and perhaps I'll say perhaps difficult for us about God and his sovereignty. Because what we can see is that God is sovereign despite resistance. But even more than that, God can be sovereign through resistance, using that resistance. God can be sovereign through resistance. And what I mean by this is yes, God is sovereign as in, and is in control and therefore triumphs over any resistance to him. But also, God in his infinite sovereignty, in his wisdom, will even use the resistance against him itself to again show His glory, to again bring about His plan. When we read here of plague after plague after plague, of refusal after refusal, you might ask, God, why are you stringing this out so much? You're God, why not deal with it in one plague? And why do we see on top of that God hardening Pharaoh's heart further, not just Pharaoh hardening his own heart? It can look like God is purposefully drawing out the saga instead of wrapping it up quickly. Well, here we see more than God being sovereign despite resistance. Here we see Him using that very resistance against Him to display His glory even more, to show Israel just how powerful He is to keep His covenant and rescue them. Take a look again at Exodus 9, 13 to 16, that Steph read out earlier. I'm going to read it out again because it's right in the thick of the plagues when the plague of hail is about to happen. It says this, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh and say to him, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says, let my people go so that they may worship me, or this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, so you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth.'" Verse 15, "For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth, but I have raised you up, this Pharaoh, I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth." See how God's working there? If Pharaoh had given up after the first plague, the story would have ended, yes, but it would have ended quickly and quietly and probably not as memorably. Instead, God ordains, and indeed He uses, Pharaoh's hardened heart. He uses that resistance. He uses that disobedience and sin to display the full weight of His glorious sovereign rule. See, Pharaoh's resistance, Pharaoh's hardness here, isn't a delay to God's sovereign plan. It's the means that God uses to display His glory and bring about His plan. God is sovereign despite resistance, but even through it, even using it. He will use, wonderfully, He will use even resistance. He will even use an evil rejection of Him like Pharaoh to bring about His glory, bring about His merciful rescue. And wonderfully, Exodus, the plagues, it's a mere rehearsal. Exodus is a shadow of where God has done this in its fullest. Because the clearest and the most globally climactic place we see this actually happen is about 1,500 years after the Exodus. The place where God displays His sovereign power and plan despite resistance and even through it. Where's that? You guessed it. At the cross. Take a look at Acts 4, 27-28. This is how the Apostle Peter describes the cross that will bring you and me salvation. He says this, "Indeed, Herod and Pontius Pilate met together with the Gentiles and the people of Israel in this city to conspire against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed." That's a clear picture of resistance to God. Verse 28. "They did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen." So at the cross, we see the absolute sovereignty of God acted out to provide us mercy, to rescue us not from slavery in Egypt, but from the deepest slavery of sin and death. And we see there at the cross, We read it in the gospel accounts. At the cross, there was a real intention by people to sin, wasn't there? There was real intention to destroy and even murder. There was such resistance to God that people decided to put his one and only son to death. Yet, through that horrifying resistance to God of Pontius Pilate and Herod and the Jewish leaders in the crowd, through that hardening of hearts, through that rejection of God, God's saving purposes were accomplished once and for all. The worst thing that human beings had ever done, executing the Son of God, became the very means by which God offers salvation. Not despite the cross, but through it. Praise be to our sovereign God for working in this and through that resistance to bring us freedom and eternity with him. And so, brothers and sisters, when you put on the news and it shows another war and pain, when your own life is weighed down with its own pain and broken relationships, even when a loved one still hasn't come to Christ, despite your earnest prayer, please see that God is sovereign, despite resistance and even through it. That in his perfect wisdom, not mine, because I don't have it. In his perfect goodness, not mine, because I don't have it. His perfect power, his plans for this world, his plans for your life and my life, they are never out of his glorious hand. And see that in all that sovereignty, what does he do? He offers us mercy. He brings rescue. He brings the real exodus from sin and death. And it means that in his sovereignty, he deserves our worship. Who is the Lord that I should obey him? He is the great I am. There is no one like him. Proclaim his name in all the earth. Salvation belongs to our God who sits upon the throne. And unto the Lamb, praise and glory, wisdom and thanks, honor and power and strength, be to our God forever and ever.